The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, that in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, the capital. You won't miss, when you read Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm sure you have not missed, that the dating of the writings now are linked to what? Not the kings of Israel or Judah, but what? But to the Babylon or Assyria or Babylon or whatever, now Persia. Because Israel as a nation no longer exists. And this will be true from now on in their history, of course. The month of Kislev, this was the ninth month in the Jewish calendar. And he was in Susa. Susa is, I forget, we can't point with this, but it's down there just north of the Persian Gulf, just east of the Euphrates and what's the other one? Tigris River. Okay, down in that fertile valley area, that's where the citadel was. This was the site, the capital, the palace, where Daniel saw the bull with what? Two horns, chapter 8 of the book of Daniel. It was also the palace where in 478 B.C. Esther became the queen to Xerxes. And so that's where they live. It was the winter residence of the king of Persia. And then in the summer, they would go back north and west a ways to Babylon, where they had another residence. And so he says, I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped and who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. Josephus has an interesting account, or he presents it as an account of what happened here. He says that Nehemiah was in the palace one day there in Susa, and he heard the voices of individuals who were speaking in Hebrew. And so naturally, being attracted by that, he went, found them, and so forth. And they told him about the conditions that prevailed there back in Judah, and how that the peace people were being harassed by their northern neighbors in Samaria primarily, although, as we'll see in a moment, there were others as well. And he said that it was so bad that it was not uncommon at all for them to find dead bodies along the roadways on occasions. Well, that's what Josephus says. It doesn't entirely line up with what the scriptures say, particularly with reference to Hanani, who is referred to here as Nehemiah's brother. We cannot be for sure that he was his blood brother, his fleshly brother. You know, we've talked many times before in our studies about how this word is used in the Old Testament. It can mean just a relative, a cousin, or whatever. But the fact that he's also mentioned again in the 7th chapter of Nehemiah, and when we learn that Nehemiah places him in charge of the gates of the city, making sure that they stay locked and so forth, it's spoken of there in such a way that leads a lot of commentators, and I think the casual reader would tend to think that he's talking about a fleshly brother. But anyway, A little bit like what Josephus said. Doesn't mention anything about dead bodies. But Hanani, his brother, and it is true that like Josephus' account, there were others with him. It wasn't just his brother, but his brother and some others had come from Judah. I don't know whether they had been sent there and came back or whether they were among one of the groups that had gone there before and now were just coming back to visit. I don't know, but they had recently come from Judah. And so Nehemiah wants to know about what's going on. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who has had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. He's not referring to something that had recently happened and caused the destruction of the walls. No, he's referring to what happened in 141 years prior to this time when Nebuchadnezzar came into Jerusalem and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple and knocked the walls down to a large degree. In other words, what he's saying is things are still like they have been since Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. And as soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Ezra, Nehemiah, Daniel, these and many others were men of prayer. And so he, upon hearing this, Nehemiah was born in captivity. And yet somebody, somehow, had instilled with him a love for his people and for the land of his people, that God had given them, the land of Canaan. Though likely he had never been there, seen it himself. But when he heard about how things were, he mourned and wept and mourned for days and continued fasting and praying. And here's his prayer. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you this day, and you day and night, for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you, even I and my father's house of sin. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant. These are the expressions that are used throughout the scripture in references the law of God. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, I think we can learn a lot about praying. I remember hearing Brother Gustin when we read the prayers from the Old Testament. I remember Brother Gus Nichols saying on one occasion that we should express unto God all our holy desires. And he was just pointing out the fact that in Nehemiah's prayer, we learn something about prayer, what it is, what it should be. Nehemiah is talking to God as if he might be talking to his father who was sitting across the room for him. And it's interesting to me that he says to God, remember the word that you commanded, like God might forget it. He's not going to forget it, but he's talking to God. He's just talking to him. And I think that's something we perhaps need to keep in mind when we pray. We're not trying to impress others or whatever. We're just talking to God and expressing to him our holy desires and such like. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are faithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. Even though he makes reference here to the uttermost parts of heaven, what he's talking about is the uttermost parts of the earth. You know, when the Assyrians came in and destroyed the northern kingdom, people from that area were taken away, and the Assyrians kind of spread them out into different places. When the Babylonians came in and captured Jerusalem, they took the captives and placed them in different places. So that's what he's referring. But this expression to the uttermost parts of heaven, I think what that has reference to is they didn't have the access to the things that you and I have access to. We have actually been able to see the earth, haven't we? From the lens of a camera way up in space. And we're looking back up on the earth, much like you might hold a glass in your hand and look on it. And they didn't have that. They could see as far as they could see on the horizon. And then what happened? The sky would come down and meet the horizon. And so the expression to the uttermost parts of the heaven is simply a way of expressing that these people who had been scattered everywhere would be brought back. God said, as long as you turn to me and keep my word, they are your servants, he said in verse 10, and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. There were those who still delighted in the word of God and who prayed for deliverance and for help. And he's calling this to the attention of God. And give success to your servant today. He's talking about himself. And grant him mercy in the sight of this man. What he's talking about? He's fixing to explain to us what he's talking about. He's about to appear before the king again as his cupbearer. Apparently, he'd not been able to do that recently, or we'll talk about that in just a minute. But he says, give success to your servant today. I'm going to talk to the king about something, and I need to know that you're with me and that I'll have success. And grant him mercy. That is him, grant me mercy, in the sight of this man. This man is a reference to the king of Persia. And he explains to us who he is in the last sentence here. Now, I was cupbearer to the king. So he's talking about the king of Persia. Now, if we turn right over to chapter 2, we'll kind of, all this begins to make sense, a little more sense. So now in the month of Nisan, now Chislev was the ninth month. Nisan is the first month. And so we're talking about approximately 4 months here, during which time Nehemiah had been praying and fasting. And because of what he had learned about the condition of people back in Jerusalem, And he's already made up his mind that he wants to talk to the king about permitting him to do something. And so in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, and we've already determined now this is Artaxerxes Longimanus, when wine was before him, I think what this means is when both the wine and I were before him. I don't know whether the king had been away in the summer palace or on some trip, or maybe the king had been in Susa, but it just wasn't Nehemiah's time to be serving the king. Or perhaps he had been serving him, but he'd been kind of keeping quiet about what was, but I don't. Personally, not that it matters, but I think he's just come around his time again. But anyway, when wine was before the king, in other words, when it was time for him to do his job, I took up the wine, and we talked last week about what that meant. He would wash the king's cup in the king's presence. He would take some of the wine and pour it in the cup, and then he would take the cup of the king filled with wine and pour a little into his palm, and then he would drink that in the presence of the king. And if he didn't fall dead, he'd hand the cup to the king. And so I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had been sad. I had not been sad in his presence. You were not allowed to be sad in the presence of King of Persia. I mean, you risk your life, you know. And the king said to me, I think this is an indication that he knew Nehemiah well. He wasn't just some employee that came before him on occasion that he paid no attention to. He said, "Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." And when reading between the lines, he must have said, "What's wrong? Tell me what's wrong." "Then I was much afraid. I was much afraid." Well, he was about to make a request that if it didn't go well, it could cost him his head. "I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city and the place of my father's graves lies in ruins and the gates have been destroyed by fire?'" He takes this out of the political realm to diffuse it as much as possible. So he doesn't talk about what had happened and how that his people had been destroyed and the city had been destroyed and people. No, he just says, when I think about my homeland where the graves of my ancestors are and the shape that it's in now, why shouldn't I be sad? And the king said to me, well, and he said to the king, "Let the king live forever." And then the king said to me, verse 4, "What are you requesting?" Now notice this. "So I prayed to the God of heaven." Now, don't get the idea that he kneeled down and or said, "Wait a minute, let me go." No, he's standing before it, and the king's asking him a question, and he's about to answer him in just a matter of seconds. But he breathes, or he what? Prays. Have you done that? I remember, I don't know if many of you know, Fenter probably does. Well, I'll declare, my mind, brain's not working good. The gospel preacher, I've got to think of his name because it won't make sense if I don't. Paul Murphy. How many of you ever heard Paul Murphy? Okay. Paul Murphy, I would go hear him preach sometime in a gospel meeting. He held lots of meetings. That's basically what he did, evangelistic work. And he would often begin his speaking by saying, "Now, will you pray while I preach?" I had never heard anyone say that before in that setting, nor have I since. But what he was saying was, "I'm going to preach, and I want you while I'm... this is serious, and I want you to pray." That's kind of what Nehemiah was doing here. Before he spoke, he prayed that God would be with him and give him success. "And I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it.' And the king said to me, 'The queen sitting beside him, I remember seeing her name. Most of these kings at this part of the world at that time were polygamous. They had many wives or a harem. That sometimes they would choose one to kind of serve as queen. Occasionally, the queen mother, the mother of the king, would be the queen. I read that some commentators, one in particular, quoted some Persian historian, and he thinks that perhaps he had only one wife, and that this this queen was his one wife. I don't know. But anyway, it just says the queen was with him, sitting with him, and the king said to me, How long will you be gone? When will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a dime. Have you thought, as we've been reading and studying Ezra and now Nehemiah, I don't know that God ever did anything for the Jewish people, or for any people for that matter, more remarkable than what we're reading about in the, with the exception, of course, of his delivering them from Egyptian bondage. But you think about this. Here are these people, their homeland has been destroyed, they've lost their nation, they're captives, they're scattered all over the place, and Zerubbabel first is allowed to return and rebuild the temple, not just rebuild it. He was given all that he would need to do that. Ezra was sent back to make sure the people were instructed in the law. And now Nehemiah is going back with not only authority from the Persian king, but with a personal escort of soldiers, with letters to all the people in the area saying that this man is my man and I've sent him on this mission to do this and you work with him. And is that not incredible? And God can do wondrous things. And a lot of times, as he's doing here, he does them just through the natural course of things, working out his will. Some have wondered, why in the world would a Persian king do this? Send someone back to rebuild the walls of a city and to equip it and perhaps make it strong again that might someday become their enemy? Well, and of course, there are different things. I don't want to get into this, but you remember back when we were in Ezra chapter 4 and all those letters that were sent and so forth. And there, one view is that a big portion of that chapter is a kind of a, what's the word for it? It really belongs to a much later time. And I told you then, and I still believe, I don't subscribe to that. But one view of this makes this remarkable is that they say this is the king, because those who took that position in chapter 4 says that it's talking about a time during the period of Xerxes Longimanus that we're talking about here. I don't believe that. Didn't then, don't, still don't. But they say this is remarkable because this is the man who had told them to stop the building altogether. And now he's sending somebody. Well, I don't think that's the case. But it is still remarkable that a Persian king. But we talked about perhaps God did it just through this. There is evidence that there were one or two in the region who were beginning to flex their muscles. In fact, one individual whose name I don't recall right now had caused an uprising that had been put down. And so it may be that the Persian king just felt that it would be in his to his benefit to have a city in the area well defended, that were his people. You know, they were still servants to the Persian. So, I don't know, God can do things in all kinds of ways, but here he is equipping him to go. And so, let's see, where are we? So, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. He would be going through a lot of country and a lot of different satraps, military leaders, governors, and there were a bunch of them in that area. Of course, we're going to read about some of them in particular. And so it would be good for the king. So, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of God was upon me. This Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, If you've done some reading on your own, you know that commentators are divided on this. A good number of them think that this is talking about Lebanon, and where timber usually was acquired for when it was needed in that area. But the word here translated it doesn't describe just an ordinary forest. It refers to more to what we would look at as a park. And in fact, I think it's the word. Floyd could tell us, but I think this is the word that eventually comes to be paradise, you know, and it's a special place, usually walled in some way. And so there are others who believe that this was something closer to Jerusalem. And I'm inclined to think that myself for a number of reasons. But anyway, that's really beside the point. But he gave him letters that would enable him to get the timber that was needed primarily for the gates, repairing the gates. So I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with me officers of the army and horsemen. And when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. Who does that remind you of? Ezra did the same thing, didn't he? After getting there, he waited 3 days. And then I arose in the night, and a few men with me, and I told no one that what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and the gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went up to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, and there was no room for the animal that I was under. And I went up by night by the valley and inspected the wall. I told you last week that American Standard Version translates this, I went up by night by the brook. And so I think what they're talking about here is by the Kidron, by the brook of the valley, Kidron Valley. And I inspected the wall and turned back and entered by the... All right, let's see if we can make this... Oh, yeah, okay. All right, here it is. Well, yeah, here's the... No. There it is. Again, I can't point, but you see the valley gate up there on the west side. Now, this is approximate, you know. No one knows exactly about the wall of Jerusalem at this time. But he came out the valley gate. That's over toward the valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, to the Jews. And he came down here to the dung gate down at the bottom, turned north, and went over and see where all that rubble is. Right along in there is where he had to dismount his horse. It was so, and I think I shared with you, and I think Ferris has talked to us about this in the past. This was where the terrain was very steep there, and they had made it into terraces, you know, and some people had built homes on those terraces. But when they destroyed the walls and a lot of those homes, those large stones just tumbled down into the valley, and it was so congested there that he couldn't go anymore on his horse. So he got down, went over apparently into the Kidron Valley, and as he walked up the Kidron Valley, he could see, maybe it was a well, the moon gave enough light, he could see the eastern wall, enough of it to kind of know what he was facing. So he returned, went back into the gate. No one knew. He had not told anybody in Jerusalem why he had come, what he planned to do. He went out that night just by himself and a few associates, and went out at night and observed the gate, went back, and no doubt as he lay in bed that night, he began to devise the plan. What are we going to do? And so we'll find out in just a minute what he's going to do. So the next day, Verse 17, then I said to them, you see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem is in ruins and so forth. Verse 18, I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words of the king that had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, a servant, and Geshem the Arab heard of it. And they jeered at us, despised us, and said, what is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and his servants will rise and build, and you have no part in this. Now, chapter 3 is the plan that he devised. And we're not going to read all that. It's kind of tough working through all those names and all, but I want to just make a reference or two enough to kind of give you the feel. This, though Nehemiah is not mentioned, this is the plan that he had worked out and that he talked with the leaders about and how they were going to build this wall. He was going to involve everybody, even the high priest. Now, the high priest, Eliashib, will later oppose Nehemiah in a lot of ways. He'll even become aligned with Sanballat and Tobiah and so forth. But when it came to building the wall, everybody was all in. Everybody was all in. And so everybody was working, from the high priest to the rulers of the city to the people in general. It's estimated that we're probably talking about 20 to 25,000 men. Maybe a little more capable of working, but even the women, many of the women were involved in this. So this was an all hands on deck effort. And so in chapter three, verse one, then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priest, and they built the sheep gate. Now they didn't just do this on their own. You remember, we've just read that Nehemiah had talked with them. And told them why he had come and what he was to do. And this is when he shared with them his plan, and everybody bought into the plan, and it begins. Now you'll see back to up, see the red up there, that's the sheep gate. That's what we're reading about in verse 1. And this wall is just under 4 miles in length. And the work is assigned counterclockwise. If you take your pencil and follow along, you'll find that there are about 40 sections of the wall, including gates, that are mentioned separately. About 40 sections. 38 foremen or overseers are named specifically. Some are named twice. We'll make reference in a minute to at least one, maybe two, that after finishing the part that was first assigned to them, they went somewhere else where they were needed and worked there and finished that. But it was all assigned counterclockwise, beginning with the sheep gate up there and all the way around that thing. So they built the sheep gate, they consecrated it and set its doors. And now remember, these pictures that I've got, of course, we don't have any pictures of 445 B.C., but this gives you an idea of what we're talking about. We're not talking about just a little wall like you see in Tennessee, you know, where they pick stones up out of the field and make a... These are high, and the gates are of different sizes depending upon where they were and what their use was, but some of them were massive gates, and you remember they were built to sustain war enemies and so forth, and so gives you some idea of what these were. Well, I don't know, it's going crazy. So they built the sheep gate. That's kind of good that they did that, because the sheep gate was the... Well, I guess I do need to go back and stop there, don't I, if I can make it go. Well, it's decided it doesn't. Oh, big help, turn it on. Okay. Sheep Gate, the temple was up in that area, the northeast corner. And so that gate was close to the temple and where they would bring the sheep in and to the one of the pools that were up there. Ferris could tell us which one, but where they could wash the sheep and so forth. So they started and worked up there. They concentrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananel. And so those are the things that are mentioned here in your scripture. Next to them in verse 2, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zachar, the son of Imra. A few weeks ago, Ferris talked to us about this area in Jericho where Sodom and Gomorrah is located and so forth. That these people from Jericho are from that area of there. The sons of Hasaniah built the Fish Gate, and they laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts and bars. You can see they would need some timber to build those gates and make them strong. And next to them, verse 5, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. We'll later read, however, that's true only of the nobles. The common people who were from that area, Tekoa, they not only did the part assigned to them, but they were one of the ones that did a double duty, you see. So it goes on like that. Look at verse 13. Hanan and the inhabitants, repaired the valley gate, verse 13. Remember, we're back down here now to where he began his night ride. So they're coming counterclockwise, assigning the work around the gate. Okay, we'll drop down now to the close of the chapter. Verse 31, after Micaiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired as far as the house of the temple servants and of the merchants opposite the muster gate and to the upper chamber of the corner. I read that simply because these also are individuals who worked in two different places. So a lot of people would finish their original part. And then the last verse, and between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. So you're back now all the way up to the sheep gates. He's made the assignments all the way around. Now, I was hoping to get through this day. We won't finish chapter 4, but we'll get started. So, at first, as we read a while ago, at first, Sanballat and Tobiah and those guys just kind of jeered, just kind of made fun of them. Who do they think they are? But now they see, look at verse, well, let's read. When Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged and jeered at the Jews. He said in the presence of his brothers and the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heap of rubbish and the burned ones at that?" You may have wondered, where did they get their stones? Well, there are a lot of stones everywhere after the destruction. Now, true, stones can be damaged by fire. And so those stones that encased the gates, some of them were weakened by the fire, no doubt. But most of the other stones were good to go. Just like there was a time, people don't do it much, but I can remember there was a time when people liked to use old brick, you know, to build a house. And they would go tear down a house and they'd get somebody to clean up the brick, you know. And so that can be done. And that's what they were doing. Tobiah the Ammonite was beside himself. He said, "Yes, they're building. If a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." Well, it's not just accidental that he used this analogy, because the history tells us that foxes inhabited that area after the destruction of Jerusalem. They liked to. Kay and I had a last year. We had a fox that came and lived on our place and raised some little ones, and they look for places, you know, where they can make their dens or whatever it is. Verse 4, "Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt." We'll stop in just a minute. "Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captive." Verse 5, "Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." Verse 6, "So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." We'll stop there until next week. But what he's saying here, they didn't stop when it was half. But the point is, up until now, these enemies are just jeering them, just criticizing them, poking fun at them. But all of a sudden, this thing keeps getting better. And at some point, when they'd gotten to where pretty much the entire wall was done about halfway up, they said, "Hey, this is not working. We're going to have to do something besides just criticize them." So we'll read next week of what they did beyond that, or how they made plans to actually make war against them or whatever, and we'll see how that was repulsed. Any quick question or comment? And I apologize for moving so fast that we didn't have time for discussion. Thank you.